I've had the pleasure of hosting many panels and plenaries at the Left Forum over the years, and I'm doing it again this time. I'll be hosting the Saturday plenary on the 50th anniversary of Stonewall and a session with Chris Hedges and Rick Wolf on Lennon. So come meet me, Laura Flanders, and the others at the 2019 Left Forum and be part of a conversation about radically imagining and building a different future. Make a pledge of $50 today and lock in your free weekend pass to the Left Forum, taking place in Brooklyn June 28th through June 30th. That's the 28th through the 30th in Brooklyn. Go to give, then the numeral 2, WBAI.org. That's give to WBAI.org and search Left Forum. Thanks for your support and thanks for listening. See you at the Left Forum.
On June 19th, the Healing of the Nations Foundation presents its fifth annual Juneteenth celebration at Carnegie Hall. The program includes Wyclef Gordon and Cyrus Chestnut. Honorees are the Justice League's Carmen Perez, Flagpole Scaler, Bree Newsom, and Bishop Michael Curry. Soledad O'Brien and Bill Moyers will present, and Riverside Church Minister Emeritus, Reverend Dr. James Forbes Jr. will host. Tickets are free, and for more information, go to Juneteenth-NY.com. That's Wednesday, June 19th at 7 p.m. at Carnegie Hall, and broadcast from 9 p.m. to midnight on listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Get ready for the world-renowned Vision Festival of Free Jazz Music and Art. Join Arts for Art on June 9th at Anthology Film Archives and downtown Brooklyn's Roulette from the 11th through the 16th for nightly avant-garde jazz, poetry, dance, and visual art performances by 35 different groups and drummer Andrew Surreal's Lifetime Achievement Award. Schedule and ticket infos at artsforart.org. That's arts with an S for art.org.
The European campaign to colonize the Caribbean was met with stiff resistance from indigenous peoples across the region, especially the Garifunas on St. Vincent. Tune in at midnight to 2 a.m. on Friday, June 14th, when the Garifuna Jazz Ensemble will be in-studio guests of the award-winning Midnight Ravers, playing the music and discussing the history and culture of the legendary Garifuna Black Caribs. Again, that's Midnight Ravers, Friday, June 14th, midnight to 2 a.m. for the legendary Garifunas on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time is 7 o'clock. Time once again for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Alex.
Good evening.
And Kyle.
Hey, what's up?
Well, we have quite a show for you tonight. We'll be talking about the whole Maker Faire thing that you've probably heard about. But we also have other late-breaking news. Alex, I saw you all over the news last night, and apparently something happened with The Strand. So maybe fill us in. What's going on?
Sure. I'd be very glad to. Things really came to a boil with our Strand matter.
Every channel you were on. How'd that happen?
Is that right?
You got good media.
We did. We had a huge press conference yesterday after the Landmarks Preservation Commission had a vote as to whether to designate The Strand as a landmark, something we've been fighting since late 2018. And things really came to a boil over the last week. I'll explain a little bit of the backstory here for listeners that haven't been keeping up with this issue. So I'm a lawyer. My law firm represents the Strand Bookstore. The city of New York wanted to designate the Strand as a landmark, which sounds like a good thing. However, it's a little bit counterintuitive because it comes with a lot of costs, a lot of encumbrances. The Strand is a 92-year-old bookstore. Its existence, you know, month to month could be really an ongoing and marginal proposition given the economics of bookstores today and online markets, et cetera, et cetera. So we've been fighting the designation because it would add so many layers of costs, administration, architects, CAD renderings for you know, things that operationally the Strand would need to do on an ordinary and not necessarily daily but a very routine basis. A bookstore like this just can't sustain those types of costs. So we've been fighting the city on this, and in particular the Landmarks Preservation Commission. We made some really good headway with them over the last few months and having several meetings. We put on the table a preservation easement that would have created a win-win situation by having the building not regulated by the city, not regulated by Landmarks, but the facade protected by what's known as an easement that would be held by a third party, and they would determine whether certain changes to the building could be made. All of this is a non-issue because the building itself is not in any danger whatsoever. Nancy Bass Wyden's family has been an extraordinary good steward of this building for many decades, and they are the owners of the Strand. So after working with the city to try to create something called a master plan, last week, about 7 or 8 days ahead of the public hearing that was scheduled for June 11th, we wrote to Landmarks, and we said to them, "We're asking you for really good reasons to delay this vote. Number one, we need more time to create the master plan. We want you to look at this before we decide to go forward with landmarking. If you want our buy-in, you want our collaboration, we need more time to do this. And by the way, it's a hell of a lot more expensive than you led us to believe it was. And number two, on February 5th, way back when this year, we sent you a FOIL request. FOIL is the New York State equivalent of FOIA, so it stands for the Freedom of Information Law. By which you can access certain agency records, and they have to give them to you. Those are records that belong to the public. So this FOIL request about their documents that pertain to the designation of the Strand in 826 Broadway, it was just languishing for about 5 months, and they never gave us any of that information. All that information should be, we are entitled to it, and it's relevant to how we create this master plan. And then Friday, late Friday, they told us, they called me up and said, "We're not going to give you that adjournment. We're going to push forward with this vote on Tuesday, whether you like it or not." I pleaded with them for about an hour not to do this because it was a major breach of trust and it would blow up all the progress that we made. And if you want to work with us, why would you do this? And they barreled ahead with the vote. We were at the commission on Tuesday when they made the vote. And not only did they unanimously, all the commissioners, vote to designate the Strand as a landmark, ignoring over 12,000 signatures of a petition to oppose this landmark designation, ignoring major authors like Fran Lebowitz, Gary Steingart, Hank O'Neill, Nicolia Rips. A lot of really great people had spoken on behalf of the Strand, people that would ordinarily support the preservation of these buildings, but they realized they could have a very destructive effect on the Strand. Ignoring all of the testimony, all of the letters that were written in, and they decided to rely on their own so-called wisdom that they would be able to regulate this building in an effective manner, and they unanimously voted to landmark us. And this came really as no surprise. We knew eventually that we were going to be Landmark, but we just thought that they would give us the benefit of the doubt and work with us for a little bit longer. Like I said, this was a major breach of trust. And what was actually really surprising about the hearing, though, was that one of the commissioners made extraordinarily rude, condescending, and insulting remarks about the Strand, its arguments, and the over 12,000 people of this city that have opposed that designation.
Well, let's hear those remarks. What were they?
Sure. She said that the Strand...
And who is she?
Her name is Addie Ben-Sharon, I think. This is a woman who has a sort of architectural history background, works at UNESCO and whatnot. But she called the Strand supporters intellectually dishonest and accused us of engaging in hypocrisy. And that was not contradicted by the chairwoman, Sarah Carroll, of Landmarks. It was just let to stand on the record. Now, let me ask you this. Is that something an agency would do or would an agency would tolerate if they actually have any interest whatsoever in working with the Strand and trying to come up with a workable solution? And here's something that I think the listeners will be very interested in, and you too, Emmanuel, is that less than a day before the vote, they dumped on us thousands of pages of documents in response to that FOIL request. So we had no time to go through it, and they were going to push forward with this vote. I mean, it all seemed designed to get to ram this thing through because perhaps they were hiding something. Well, thankfully, we have a decent staff, and the day before the vote, we went through lots and lots of these documents. And some of the things we found in there were actually quite interesting. For instance, like the fact that Landmarks was doing what would amount to opposition research and was way more interested in Nancy Bass Wyden's personal life, her finances, her political views, than they were in the architectural integrity of 826 Broadway, the building of the Strand. Moreover, they were seeking out disgruntled Strand employees to try to get them to testify on their behalf at our last public hearing. And in addition, there are a whole bunch of documents that are redacted between the mayor's office, the deputy mayor's office, and Landmarks, and then with third parties that used to work at Landmarks themselves, things that should definitely not be redacted. So there's a lot of irregularities. This is far from over. We knew we were going to be Landmarked. We thought that we would hopefully be able to work out a plan with them. I don't think there's going to be a reverse gear here, so we're taking this fight to the grassroots level.
Okay.
This is about the people now. It's about joining in and helping to protect the Strand. They set up an email address, protectthestrand@gmail.com, if you want to join in the fight. But this is about working now from the bottom up. What Nancy had said at our press conference yesterday, which wasn't really covered a lot by the media, but I think was a really important point, is that change does not happen in government buildings. Change happens on the streets. That's why we were outside yesterday at our press conference on the streets of New York, right outside the Strand. Major press coverage, as you noted. So this is going back to the grassroots level. We are considering legal options as well, given what we have already found in the FOIL request. We have other outstanding FOIL requests. And in fact, it was incomplete what they sent to us. We're going to still dig around in that and hopefully come to a conclusion about whether we're going to take legal action within the next few months.
Is there an immediate cost on all of the actions you're looking at, notwithstanding? Is there an immediate cost, given what determination they came to at this meeting in imposing this status? What kind of costs could the Strand and customers of the Strand face immediately, given that they want to go ahead in defiance of the requests and the petitions that were made by customers?
Well, there's not going to be an immediate cost right now. Anytime something is going to want to change to the building, if they're going to, well, like, let's say, put in a handicap ramp. That's actually something that's going on right now, is a changing
yeah,
handicap ramp.
Examples like that that are
something that simple.
On the
so,
horizon.
Yeah, there will be. In fact, we're already having to deal with this bureaucracy, and it's not, and it hasn't been pleasant. Let me tell you that. It's been contradictory between Landmarks and the Department of Buildings, and so there's a lot of issues there. But the costs are going to be incurred pretty rapidly when any kind of change is going to be done to the building. So, for instance, if the Strand wants to put in a cafe, which they're contemplating doing on the ground floor level, things can get really expensive really, really quickly. But like I said, this fight is far from over. We need your support as well. We want you to, you know, stay tuned, listen in, and we have some tricks up our sleeves, some things that may have been born out of my misspent youth hanging around with you guys that should be announced over the next few weeks.
Okay. Oh, I would definitely down for that. And is there a website people can get updates on?
I would mostly check the Twitter feed. which is Strand Books, and I believe it's strandbooks.com as well, where there's constant updates about this. But the Twitter feed is probably one of the best places to go for constant updates.
Okay.
And anybody can reach out to me directly as well. We're blackstone-law.com.
Okay. You need a website. You guys need a website to keep updated because that's how people spread the news around.
And completely agree.
Yeah, I feel like that's the next thing is you'll be updating us with a domain where people can find out more about this movement.
Hopefully next time we have that. Here. Alex, thanks for that, and it was fun seeing you on all the channels yesterday. We have another major story that broke over the weekend. For those of you who have not heard about that, I'm just going to read you a little bit from a story from Gizmodo, online publication, that's basically starting by saying TechCrunch has learned, another online publication. Okay, so one online publication is quoting another online publication that's saying TechCrunch has learned that Maker Media, the company behind the DIY magazine and online publication Make, as well as the Maker Faire Science, Art, and Hacking Festivals that happen all around the world each year, ceased operations last week and let go the rest of its 22 employees. The company's founder and CEO, Dale Dougherty, confirmed to TechCrunch that since its inception 15 years ago, the business has been a struggle, as it has been four, they spelled four wrong. See, this is the problem. When you have just online publications, the proofreading goes out the window. Yeah, four countless, more than four. It's been four, I'm confused now. Okay, the business has been a struggle, as it has been for countless print publications over the past few decades, yes. Layoffs first hit the company back in 2016, followed by eight more staffers being laid off in March, which the San Francisco Chronicle reported ahead of the 2019 Maker Faire. There was some forebodings of doom there. The company's flagship event, which is held in the Bay Area each year. And despite rain, though, that event met its ticket sales. But doubtful it's going to return to the Bay Area after this year. And then, of course, there were the two Maker... actually, that was one of the Maker Faires, one of the two flagship ones, the other one being here in New York, the World Maker Faire. Now, according to Dougherty, other regional Maker Faires simply licensed the name and branding. So those are still... supposedly going to proceed for at least 2019. But what it looks like from the gist of this is that Make Magazine is finished and Maker Faires are finished. The big ones are finished. We have on the line with us the voice of Maker Faire for so many years on this radio station whenever we would participate in the annual event here in New York. Sherry Huss, sad times.
Yeah, oh, for sure, for sure. Hello, everyone. And first of all, thank you for your continued support. I think the 2600 community has always been really special and has been great. And I think even as Alex mentioned, I think the one thing to remember is that change happens on the streets. And I truly believe it. It's how we built Maker Faire. And I think even though it's hard that the big fairs are going to go away and there's some business realities that are being dealt with, the great news is that the seeds have been planted. And even this morning, I came from a step-up ceremony for a kindergartner at her school, and I saw that they had a Maker Lab. And there was a sign, and it's like, I can't be happier that we've made change in the first 15 years. And I think it's up to all of us now to figure out where we take it.
Well, you know, I think...
And I think it's... Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, and I mean, I think, again, Maker Faire has been so wonderful, and I do believe they will continue on a local level. In my mind, when we started Maker Faire, it was the county fair for me. Like, every county fair should be a Maker Faire, and there's part of this. To me, Maker Faires just need to be part of culture and what we celebrate, just like craft fairs or farmers markets. The big ones were hard to maintain, but I actually think that it's an interesting time now, and we have many, many, many more people around the globe that are involved, even young makers that have been with us for 15 years, that now can actually help come together and figure out where we take it.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of all the kids, because that if you've ever been to the World Maker Faire in Queens, you'd be amazed by how many kids show up and are completely involved and learning all kinds of technical abilities and sharing their information, their knowledge. But those kids over the years have gone on to do some amazing things. And I just wonder how many of them work at SpaceX now and so many other places where they're now designing technology and spreading those ideas. The environment at Maker Faires has always been so healthy. And yes, it's similar to a county fair, but I think it goes beyond that because you have this spirit of hacking and sharing information and experimenting and being a bit mischievous and just kind of seeing where the technology takes you. Very, very healthy things for kids. I think I can count on one hand the number of unhappy kids I've seen over the years at Maker Faire. So we are interested here, both on Off the Hook and the Hope Conference and the magazine, in doing whatever we can to keep that environment alive. Obviously, the small Maker Faires around the world, but the big ones too, because they were special. And I know a lot of people are asking, you know, you have these massive fairs with, I think, over 100,000 people attending. How does something like that lose money?
Well, you know, again, this is where I think it gets complicated. The fairs are one part of the business, and one could argue that there were some fundamental issues with the overall business that actually kind of got funneled into the fair.
I see.
So I can't say that the fairs didn't always make money. They maybe didn't make enough money. And if you read the articles, you know, I had to speak at Sonoma State last week to a group of Cal State University Maker professionals that are trying to figure out what to do with this. And I broke it down into like 5-year segments. You know, the first 5 years, we started this, Make Magazine launched in 2005, and I came on board in 2006. I mean, I met Dale back in the early days. My background was starting with developer conferences. So Java One was the first event I ever did in 1996. And from then, during that period, like 96 to 2002, worked with Sun, Microsoft, Oracle, Intel. At that time, I met Dale Doherty, and Dale's a wonderful visionary. You know, I have to say that that's really the great thing about Dale is that he, you know, he kind of dreams big and he goes out there. And at that time, he had come up with the idea of Web 2.0, and O'Reilly Media wasn't really on board with actually the Web 2.0, which is interesting. But I talked my boss into the time to say, let's do a joint venture because I think this next generation of the web has some legs. And I really believe, and I was looking at it more from a developer perspective, but even from a business and entrepreneurial perspective, that was where we're going. So that's how I met Dale. The first 5 years we spent building this event, and we really created it as a festival to celebrate makers. I worked for the company that put on Comdex, and so I knew the realities of trade shows, and I knew everything I wanted to stay away from.
Wow.
I didn't want to be in convention centers. I didn't like pipe and drape. I wanted it to be family-oriented. That really kind of created the whole fair atmosphere. So that first 5 years, we actually went around and once we decided to get this festival going, we went around and, you know, found groups of people. We launched in the Bay Area, 2006, had about 22,000 to 30,000 attendees that first weekend, which was like, okay, we have something here. We took it to Austin in 2000, 2007 and 8, which we actually always could get attendees. The sponsorship was a little bit hard because, you know, it's not a standard event and companies don't know what to do. But then we got hit with the recession in 2009. At that time, we pulled back and said, okay, what are we going to do? We had a lot of people coming at us saying we want a Maker Faire. And so we decided, again, this is the brilliance of being part of O'Reilly, where being open source, we said, okay, let's create a playbook. And we had the Kauffman Foundation gave us a grant for $25,000 to start that. We also launched two events, one in Detroit. Dale had talked at a TED Auto event in Detroit and realized there's a whole host of people in kind of that rust belt that actually were either kids or family members of engineers. They could really use a Maker Faire. So we partnered with the Henry Ford, and then we partnered with the New York Hall of Science, which I have to say was brilliant because they're not only do they have a wonderful property, but they definitely shared our mission of making makers and hands-on and creativity and getting kids to go.
Yeah, such a perfect place for that. Mile. Such a perfect place.
Yep. So the first 5 years we spent building, we had to readjust quickly in 2009. And then the next pivot point was 2014 when we did a White House Maker Faire. And we were so lucky because we had the Obama administration, Tom Khalil and Kumar and their team, they were part of the Office of Science and Technology Programs, three of their initiatives match directly with us. So workforce development, that's retraining, and STEM education. So we were able, and, you know, even at the time, because, again, even the great thing of, like, pulling back from Maker Faire a little bit is you get a perspective to look up instead of always looking down. At the time, not even realizing how important that was, especially for a global move, because once we had a White House Maker Faire, the European Commission was quite interested. Oh, China was interested. Everyone was paying attention, and as well as companies and corporations, which through the help of the Office of Science and Technology Programs pulled in a lot of folks, including the Department of Energy, which I think it was around 2015 or 2016, which was the height, I'd say, of Maker Faire attendance and sponsorship. And things were just kind of like working really well, right? I mean, to have the Department of Energy be there and showcase what they were doing was pretty darn amazing.
Absolutely.
Even for kids to see, to talk to scientists and engineers, they were even government science and engineers, like, how do you get to do that? And that's kind of the brilliance of Maker Faire. And anyway, the next, you know, the last 5 years, and Make, we pulled out of O'Reilly in 2012. We took we took VC money, which was probably a kiss of death, right? I mean, there was no way what we were doing that we would ever be, you know, delivering returns out of Silicon Valley.
Well, I think you touched upon it right there. As soon as you inject venture capitalist into it, there is a sort of a poison that spreads. Because if you look at Maker Faire, if you look at what you guys have been doing, how can anybody in their right mind consider that to be anything but an unmitigated success? You had all these people showing up, having a great time, learning so much, coming year after year. How does anybody, and of course a venture capitalist would say, well, it's not making enough money. They don't quite see the vision that you guys saw.
No, absolutely. I mean, they were interested in scaling and, you know, how could we return? How could Maker Faire, you know, make more money?
I
have to say, I don't think Maker Faire made money. It didn't make as much money as we should have for the amount of work that we did. And every one of those dollars went back right into the event or to the team or what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
We were truly a mission-based organization. And I believe that's what Dale's trying to figure out now. Like, how do you pull this back? And how do you not lose the momentum? But, you know, you couldn't operate under that business construct that was, you know, unfortunately entered into.
You start grafting the expectations of that particular business mindset onto what you know works for your event, instead of making doing what works for your event and trying to make a business plan fit that. And that I think, and a lot of people can relate with who do run events, We're too familiar with sponsors not knowing what to do with you, and we don't typically take sponsorships, and we started to in the past for specific things, but not the entire event. But thinking that way, it takes a certain mindset, and I could see all of the success making venture capital and influx of investment further the mission, maybe in a short term sense, but have other consequences for what you're actually planning long term.
Absolutely. And I will say, again, I worked for the Comdex guys. Those guys were making a dollar per square foot, you know, and in 2000, you know, they sold they were $60 a square foot. They sold 1 million square feet, all cash. We weren't a money play. We were using events. And again, events have so many purposes, and events are also, they can be incredibly hard, right, to get everything right. And Maker Faire was never designed to be like, okay, here's your 10 by 10 space, move on.
Exactly.
I had a team that actually cared about the makers that would say, tell us about yourself, tell us about your project, tell us about what you need on site. And we spent the time, because we also felt that the makers were there giving of themselves over the weekend. And so we wanted to make sure, and this was part of the beginning, you know, we were pulling groups and people out of their own world. So the robot team, the robot group always talked to the robot group. You know, the Lego group always talked to the Lego group. What was so special about what we did is we pulled them out of their environments and said, we're going to give you a venue and you can showcase what you do because we believe it's special. And every one of those groups had a story. And I will say, so proud of my teams, because everyone actually had that orientation instead of, okay, 10 by 10, next, next, next.
And that
so
really,
I think that that was what was truly special about Maker Faire.
I totally agree, and that really held true for most of the people that I ever saw at the fair when I would come and work with our booth, and we'd all take turns manning the booth so that the rest of us could go around and enjoy the rest of the fair. It's stuff we were interested in, and when we would talk to people at the other booths and have full-on conversations about what we were doing, what they were doing, and everyone was interested in everything else. This was an event where where so many people were there as a labor of love and just for what was going on, and not just there to present their wares.
Yeah, yeah. To speak to that, one of our initial reactions and something that I thought of was that we need to kind of or should be a part of the conversation is how do we define success? Like, what is a successful Maker Faire? From perhaps a VC bottom line perspective, you might come to a much different conclusion than had you attended and, as E pointed out, seen the reaction to families and people who don't often get to share what they really are into, and also people that learn about new things and get exposed to it, or see the intersections, as you mentioned, with like NASA being there, or large companies that sort of validate and show, hey, this relates to the power company, or this relates to another area or a sector that wouldn't ordinarily be thought of as an inspiring career.
Yeah,
or, and,
you know, Sherry, I want to make sure this is absolutely clear, but you guys have changed lives in such an incredible way of kids everywhere. You have steered them onto a path they never would have gone down, at least not in the same way, not with the enthusiasm that they got from Maker Faires. So that's why I think we really have to work hard as members of the hacker community, as people who are creative and technical ourselves, to save this for the future kids that come along, because I want to see that magic. I want to see that continue.
No, I agree. I mean, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I got contacted by, I grew up in a town in northeastern Ohio. I went to Elyria High School, graduated class of 1976. I get a call from the superintendent of school system to say, hey, we just found out that you co-founded Maker Faire. We would love to have you come and talk to our students. Would you do it? I said, absolutely. I got there and I had to say, they were so great to show me middle schools. They've cleared out the libraries now. So the libraries now host like 3 Maker classes starting at grade 8. The high school, same thing. They cleared out the library, which was a brand new, the high school, the new part of the library was built in 2011. They cleared out the library, which I can only imagine the fights that were going on with the librarians to do this. But the level of engagement, and this is in a pretty depressed economic area in, you know, northeastern Ohio, that for 3 years, they've actually had making in their curriculum. And I could see it and feel it walking into that high school that I hadn't been in, you know, like over 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, this is changing. So I do think that there are really good things that are happening out there. And I like encourage the teachers at Cal State, like, this is the time for all of us to mobilize and we can affect change. What I've learned from Maker Faire, I mean, it's been the most rewarding job. It's been the hardest job, but a lot of it is finding the people that are doing things and then just saying, you can do this, go do it.
Absolutely.
Don't ask permission, right?
And I think
in your school,
I think we might have we might have one of the biggest challenges of things we have to do now to save this thing, to have things like this in the future, and to keep this spirit going. That, you know, this is a good community to have that challenge, because I think they can definitely meet that. Now, Alex, you have a kid who is very enthusiastic about Maker Faire, and I understand there have been some temper tantrums like you would not believe, just as has been going on around the country, I would imagine. Are you still locked out of your house? What's going on?
you would think, right? I mean, well, right. And let me tell you, I mean, it was really incredible. Last year was the first year that I brought my 5-year-old son to Maker Faire. And he was just amazed at the breadth of it. It was absolutely incredible to him. And we spent the entire day walking around. He was so fascinated by all of the robotics. And now this summer, he's going to a robotics camp. He's 6 years old. And because of the Maker Faire last year, he got so into robotics. He's going to a robotics camp this year.
At 5 years old?
6 years old now.
Okay.
Yep. And, you know, shows you how interesting everything else was, because we were hanging out with Emmanuel and Kyle at the 2600 van, and compared to everything else, he was incredibly bored hanging out with you guys, I have to say. You know, everything else was so much more interesting. You're usually the weirdest guys in the group, but, you know, right in Maker Faire, you were you know, bottom of the barrel to him. So he found the whole thing just incredible, the big hand that was crushing the cars. And when he saw the R2-D2 replicas and the BB-8 replicas, he freaked out because, you know, he's such a huge Star Wars fan. When we left that day, you know, it was sort of in the evening. You could tell he was tuckering out. We're walking back to the subway, and he looked up at me, and I will never forget this. He said to me, "Daddy, this was the best day ever."
Oh, my God.
I got to meet R2-D2. He's a real hero.
Do
you know, he said he's a real hero. And that weeks ago, before any of this news came out, this sad, disappointing news, he started asking about Maker Faire. "Daddy, when's Maker Faire? Maker Faire? When are we going?" And I haven't had the heart to tell him yet, actually.
Well, he could be listening right now, Alex.
It's
for
true.
God's sake, he knows how to use a radio.
This is true. And in fact, weirdly enough, this morning, I was going through my bag and taking some old things out, and we had some Maker Faire tattoos, you know, like the permanent, the removable tattoos that were given out.
Right.
And he wanted to put one on his hand this morning. Looks a little thuggish, but so we did it. We put it on his hand, and it you know, I have to say, it got me a little bit welled up thinking about the fact that might
multiply that by a few hundred thousand kids, and that's the experience.
I know.
Remember this for the rest of their
you.
Lives.
But the important thing is, it happened. He experienced it. He'll never forget it, and it's already, I feel like, changed the trajectory of his life.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I agree. And here's what I'm going to say, too. I think that, again, there needs to be a little time to figure out, and I know Dale's trying to figure some of it out. The license fairs are still going to go on, again, whether they're Maker Faire. I mean, hopefully they'll be called Maker Faire. But there's, you know, St. Louis. There's Detroit. Orlando.
That includes the international ones as well. I just want to clarify. Rome and
Rome and Shenzhen. They've all stated.
So then,
they're planning on moving
right
forward.
Now, the only ones affected really are San Mateo and Queens. Is that right?
That's correct. Because those were the ones that were under the Maker Media purview. That's
great.
Correct.
Yeah, because we're
a lot of things. Yep.
We're also announcing the Tokyo one, which would be part of that. So that is.
I've heard more support regionally because of this. So I think that the regional fairs are going to continue in some way, shape, or form. You know, they'll have to figure out all the legal stuff. But there is going to be a Maker Festival, and they're starting to pop up out there. Like I said, I want to see them everywhere. And I know, I mean, the big fairs do have those special moments with, you know, the fire-breathing dragons and the bigger-than-life things that actually kind of make you really, you know, if you didn't get how cool it was, it sort of reinforces it, that they're just things that, you know, even for young kids, just opening up their mind, which was, it didn't matter what they were interested in, but just knowing that there are other things out there than what's in front of you every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the important thing. And then also talking to makers, right?
Yes.
Like, how often in life do you get to talk to people anymore? You know, not that much. So those are the things that are important. Those aren't going to go away. And, you know, I have hope that it's been too significant. And again, I will say it is a movement from the people. This is happening on the streets. All the regional fairs, even Rome, Shenzhen, those are all local people that have made it happen. And again, this is just a blip, and we'll get through it. But I think it's just kind of raising, I guess, what I could say to all your audience, but I know that you practice it every day anyway. It's just kind of raising the whole awareness around making. And there are little things that you can do. When I was in Elyria, I noticed that they gave the graduating seniors varsity letters. Those were the seniors that were on the robotics team and then the Maker and Fab Lab group. And I went up to them afterwards and said, "How did you get the varsity letter? Like, varsity letters are for athletics." And, you know, and they said, actually, they pushed. Not too many places have done this yet. But these are little signs. They went and they said, these are the rules of what you need for a varsity letter. Because it's not really a sport or competition, we put in a few things, and they pushed to make it happen. Now, how cool is it that kids that are in the robotics and Maker world in high school can get a varsity letter?
That's awesome.
That's pretty cool.
That is really amazing.
And those are the things that, again, I think all of us can actually change the world that we're in. And then also be sure to share it, right? And there are enough. I mean, I think 2,600, you guys are a great medium. There are folks that have been in the maker world, you know, Gareth Branlin, Mark Frauenfelder, a lot of the editors that can actually have vehicles to get things out. I think we just have to keep continuing to share and then also supporting education. Because I'm going to tell you right now, I think the hardest thing that I'm seeing is that teachers in school really want to build making into their curriculum, and they don't always know how. So I think if there are ways that we can actually help those teachers and, you know, start working locally, that things are going to trickle up globally.
Absolutely. And I think one of the most important things, if not the most important thing, Maker Faire has accomplished in the 15 years it did exist was that it created the form factor for something that had not happened before, but that can be duplicated, as the license fairs have proved. So whether it's called Maker Faire or whether it ends up sort of mutating into something else, I think we can all be confident that this community, the hacker community, the maker community, everyone who sees value in this can make something like this happen again in this city. And San Mateo and anywhere else that that they want, because this is a thing that has been proven can happen and is of value. And you've now got 15 years of people who have experienced that value and who maybe want to put something toward making it happen again.
Uh-huh. I also want to say a couple words concerning the founder and CEO, Dale Dougherty. I totally get where he's coming from, too. I know there's a lot of people that online want to say, oh, this is what you did wrong. This is how it should be. No, it's a tough job. I feel every bit of his heartache as far as keeping print media going, keeping events going. It is difficult. I know exactly where he's coming from. And I think that he gets it as far as wanting this to continue in some way, but it has to be reorganized. And I just hope that he sticks to that and he gets the support that he deserves in order to make this happen. Because I Sherry, correct me if I'm wrong. I think he really wants this to continue, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, Dale's invested a lot, and a lot more than dollars, but in years and time that, you know, you just don't get back either.
Right.
I think that, you know, just like all of us, that this is just sort of, it's unfortunately it comes down to business right now. But the great thing is that there's so much more than business.
Yes.
Like, right. Where the business analogy falls short is that there is so much more here. And again, I think, you know, it was a hard day for sure. And, but I do agree. I know that Dale wants the best for makers and making, and I also see things kind of bifurcating as well. Like groups are also starting, you know, they kind of got the mojo, the maker mojo. And like I work with the Future Food Institute out of Bologna, Italy, and I'm seeing like global networks that are happening because of Maker Faire that are helping them take their mission, which is focusing on food and, you know, positive action, you know, through education and innovation, which is really kind of what we were trying to do with making. I'm working in San Francisco with the folks from the Museum of Future Sports. So I'm starting to see some groups that are also kind of finding their, you know, their special interest area and audience. And those things are also very positive, too.
You know, and Sherry, you know, I have some hope, you know, that this will work itself out at some point as well. Also because, and perhaps you can speak to this, this isn't actually a bankruptcy. I dug into the legality of what's going on below the scenes here. This is what's known as an assignment for the benefit of creditors. So it's hopefully going to be a process that's a lot faster and smoother than bankruptcy. Bankruptcy requires a judge to approve whatever the bankruptcy plan is, you know, in order to pay off creditors and things. This, however, it's all based off state law. Bankruptcy is federal law. This should be faster. It should be cheaper. There's no courts involved. There's no judge's approval involved. And it's all done by a contract. And my understanding here is that essentially there'll be a contract that will sort out all of the details of the bankruptcy. The title of Maker Faire's assets and control of those assets will then be put into a trust. And then those assets will be sold to pay off the creditors. But at the point of that sale, and here's my hope, and tell me if I'm being unrealistic here, but the sale of those assets could go to third parties that want to keep this going.
And then the money from that sale could be used to pay off the creditors, and another third party, perhaps Dale Dougherty himself, maybe, would be willing to repurchase some of these assets and keep bits of Maker Faire going.
That's my understanding, yeah.
It is.
Okay. Right, but, I mean, that sounds very optimistic, and I hope something like that happens. I was thinking, you know, having, you know, just say for a World Maker Faire or San Mateo, having it spun into some kind of a nonprofit that sole purpose is to run that event and get sponsorships and just make it self-sustaining. And I think, you know, seeing the success of that, I think it's possible.
Right. I agree. I think that's the hope, too. So I do think, again, I think probably the most important thing was getting out from under a bad business framework.
Right.
That was not going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been planted. There's a lot of support from the community. That's a very positive. And I think right now Dale has to kind of work through a couple of these processes.
Well, I think him knowing that he has the support of the community to help get through this, I think that'll make a world of difference.
I agree. I think he does. I agree.
You know, and again, you know, I think we should be somewhat optimistic here and be very supportive of Dale and the Maker Faire community, because like I said, you know, at the point of the sale, right, it can really go to parties that are willing to keep this going. And if it goes back to the people that originally created Maker Faire, what this looks like, and it's what Sherry alluded to, is they had a bad business structure beforehand. Maybe this is a year hiatus, maybe it's a 2-year hiatus, but it could essentially be a do-over with a better business structure. And it's up to us to keep supporting the organization, because it's obviously so important to our community and to so many kids and adults alike all around the world. So we really, really applaud you, and we're going to hope against hope here.
Well, Sherry,
yeah, I agree. And I will also say, I'd say if you can support the New York Hall of Science, too. I mean, I think they're trying to figure out, this is a big hole in their schedule for programming for the fall.
Right.
But they do have a makerspace there, and they're doing maker programs in education. I think they're going to need a little time to figure it out. But again, they're another partner that really helped kind of coalesce and pull together that whole New York community. And, you know, there are so many people that have touched Maker Faire, and there's so much love that's gone into it, from the makers to the vendors to the partners to the Maker Media staff and crew, that, you know, it's too big, and there's too much support and love for it to go away. I'm hoping it's going to emerge something stronger and kind of getting us set up for the next 5, 10, 15 years.
Well, it's great to hear the Hall of Science has that attitude as well, because they're not just somebody renting out the space and not being sympathetic. So it's you know, with all that together, we have a really good team, it sounds like.
Yeah,
no, and I'm gonna say there is no way we could have done Maker Faire in New York, given the prices with venues and that, unless we had a partner like the Hall of Science. So they were very much every step of the way there. And even when I would say things like, hey, can you remove that panel of fence? They kind of looked at me, but they were there every time, and they were right there with the maker spirit. So
they
do get a big shout out as well.
It was just great to go back to the scene of the World's Fair that I attended as a child.
Absolutely.
You know? It was
absolutely.
The most amazing thing.
Yeah,
that's a beautiful property there.
Yeah, it is.
And talking of the Hall of Science, among the emotional outpouring that we've seen on social media in response to these posts, our listener Coney Love said to us on Twitter, I think we all know that no matter what, we are all going to be at the New York Hall of Science on September 21st, Maker Faire or no Maker Faire, to raise a toast.
Well, hopefully we don't get escorted off the property. But that sounds like fun.
If you guys are going to be there, I'm sure we can work with Dan and the team there, because I know that, like I said, they've been a partner 100% of the way.
Well, I'll be there. If people are going to show up, I'll show up for sure.
And have like a mini pop-up New York.
Mini
pop-up World Maker Faire.
We'll bring the van, too. We'll bring the phone booth. Yes. We'll bring the whole thing.
I mean, the phone booth and our exhibit alone was all inspired by having seen other people and what their energy is, what they're bringing for their own exhibits. So to not have that, it's just for us. A big change, but we're still inspired by it.
And Sherry, it's in Corona. We love Corona. It's just such a great neighborhood, and it meshes really well with this whole event.
We'll find a way.
I agree.
The only downside I see to this pop-up, though, is that if it's just you there, Emmanuel, my son is going to be very disappointed.
No, it's not going to be just me. All right, tell him there'll be more interesting people than just me. Yeah.
All right. I'm gonna have
How
to manage
jaded
expectations.
Is your kid?
He's pretty jaded. He hangs right around Alex.
Oh, my God.
Sherry, you want to stick around for some phone calls?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, our phone number is 212-209-2877. We're speaking with Sherry Huss, who is the coordinator of World Maker Fair. Do you also coordinate San Mateo?
Well, I've been co-founder of Maker Fair, so I've been there from the beginning.
Pretty much all of them. What an amazing accomplishment that is. If you have any questions or comments or observations, if you've ever attended a Maker Fair, give us a call, 212-209-2877. And also, if you have anything to say about the Strand, we're talking about both big topics tonight. 212-209-2877 is our phone number. It's hard to imagine that big hole in our autumn schedule of Maker Faire, and I just hope that it's a one-time thing that maybe by 2020 things will go back to normal.
Right. And callers, absolutely, if you have some ideas, please, I'm sure Sherry and the rest of us would enjoy your contribution.
Yeah, if you're a billionaire that can solve all the problems with one phone call, that would be good too. But
well, that's another issue too. Is I thought, and I think it's probably a bit more complicated than this, Sherry. That you know, why hasn't some high net worth individual stepped in and replaced the void that was left with Maker Faire from the lack of corporate sponsorship and or the lack of enthusiasm from the corporate side? You know, do you think that that's a possibility?
Well, I actually think the dollars that make needs, especially if, you know, again, in the grand scheme of the money world, it's not huge. So even and make a take and run with small dollars. I mean, I think anything is possible. It hasn't happened because, you know, once money is involved, there gets to be a whole host of things. But
yeah, if you have to sacrifice
the
direction,
but a nonprofit structure might actually help as well.
Well, that's true. Then it would be a tax deductible donation to save the
Maker
Faire. And
but also, you wouldn't have to worry about the venture capitalists. You could just worry about the event itself and making that as good as it could possibly be. Because I can't imagine the pressure of just having that hanging over your head constantly, pleasing these people that really don't get it. Let's see if this caller gets it. We have a phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Hey, so it's Delcini, and I have a couple of comments to the Maker Faire and the Strand.
Go ahead.
Stories today. So, Maker Faire, I'm going to go all Euro-socialist on you, because in Europe, those kinds of programs are tax-funded to a large portion. And I think as a community, we need to start asking for funding for those kinds of problems, because there's more at stake here than just, a really great event, but also our position in tech in the United States and how we educate, our younger generations. And as for the Strand, I tweeted at you a link that is by the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation. People can very easily follow that link and send a letter straight from there. In that neighborhood, Carlina Rivera, she's the city council member, and it's the second time she struck out in a major way. And she needs to be sent a message as well that this just can't keep going on. She's been handing the neighborhood to developers like there's no tomorrow.
No doubt. And in fact, Carlina Rivera, as you correctly point out, she's the councilwoman who's in charge of that particular district. She spoke in favor of designating the Strand as a landmark. And it's pretty clear, too, that designating the Strand as a landmark was the product of a deal between de Blasio and Carlina Rivera, and was the result of the rezoning because of the new nonsensical Silicon Alley that's happening, this new tech hub that's happening in Manhattan, south of 14th Street. Separately, though, I think reaching out to the Greenwich Village Society is also important, too, because they are not happy with this designation either. This is a building that was certainly not under threat. It's not going to be raised. Compare that to the St. Denis Hotel just down the street, where Alexander Graham Bell, in room 208, displayed the speaking telephone to New Yorkers for the first time.
Wow.
That hotel was not landmarked. It's been raised. And so there's a lot of disparity here. It's really unfair. It's
can't go to room 208 anymore.
Yeah, no, I know. Damn. Exactly. This has been an unfair, ill-conceived process from the outset. And thank you for pointing out.
We have another phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Good evening. Every week I listen to the mayor when he's on with Brian Lehrer on WMIC. Now, I'm thinking if someone were to call in, it could be me, but I'm just putting it out there, because he does seem to follow up with people. I'm talking about the Strand.
Okay.
So maybe he could help. He's got his own situations with real estate. I understand that. So I don't know how open he'd be to it. But he seems to be working, helping people quite a bit. I listen to it all the time. So that was all I had to say, and thank you.
Thanks for your call. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that entirely. We're hoping that perhaps there is a some chance that the mayor could act on this. Statutorily, the city council now has 120 days within which they can either rescind or modify the particular designation. It's unlikely they're going to do anything. The mayor could step in after that. Thank you.
All right, let's take one more phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hey, good evening, guys. You know what? I'm thinking about it because I work at the Clearwater Festival. Why don't you bring the whole Maker Faire show to the Clearwater Festival? There's plenty of kids there that would be loving that, I'll tell you.
Uh-huh. What do you think, Sherry?
It's this weekend, you know?
Oh, it's this weekend?
Yeah, it's this Saturday and Sunday, you know?
That's short notice, but
well,
I don't know.
I mean, you know what? If I knew this sooner, I would have called you sooner. This is the first I've heard it. Because I've always wanted to go to the Maker Faire, you know?
Well, hopefully you will be able to at some point. But, Sherry, any thoughts on this?
You know, I think those are interesting ideas. It's probably not going to happen for this weekend. But, you know, you never know. Maybe put a call out and actually set up some tables for makers and, start encouraging making at the Clearwater Festival.
Well, you know, a few of us went to the mini Maker Faire at Port Jefferson last weekend, and that was really cool.
Yep.
And much smaller, yep. But the same enthusiasm was there. These things can pop up in pretty much any place you imagine.
Oh, people were coming from coming from a long way too.
Yeah,
we had
they did.
Bumped into people that were from Brooklyn, I think, and
probably further than that.
Yeah, it was amazing to see people come from the draw that these events have.
Oh, completely,
and the enthusiasm is exactly the same. Let's take.
I was gonna say, and just because they're smaller doesn't make them any less better. In fact, you have more meaningful conversations and engagements with makers.
That is true. Although there is something really special about that Queens event. I hope we see that again. Let's take one more phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hey, you know, why don't you bring your van to the Clearwater Festival?
Okay. You know what? We'll see what we can schedule. Thanks for your enthusiasm. Clearwater. Okay, yeah, let's drive up there. Let's get started.
Ani DeFranco is going to teach soldering, and Immortal Technique is going to have some races or something.
Well, Sherry, any final words from you? Things people can do, websites, anything like that?
No, I mean, you know, I would say, I think, again, this is all pretty fresh and new. I think that, you know, we'll kind of keep sharing information as it comes out. But again, I think just keep on making and keep doing what you do. And wherever you can raise awareness, that's great. And let's see if we can get this back on track.
Yeah, and the kids bawling their eyes out all across the New York metro area. We're working on this. We're going to make it better. We're going to make it happen. This magic will come back.
Right.
But you're going to help us. We need that enthusiasm.
Right.
We need your ingenuity.
Absolutely.
And I feel much more heartened having talked to you this past hour, Sherry, about the future, knowing these events are happening around the world. We just have to bring it back here and back to San Mateo. And hopefully rebuild other things as well, because this community doesn't know the meaning of the word defeat, you know? And
that's true.
We're idealistic and some might say naive, but that's our beauty.
And also, while we got a minute left, Sherry, I just want to say on behalf of us here at 2600 Maker at WBAI and everyone, you've been such a great friend to the station, you and Make, and everyone supporting what we do, and with things like tickets and whatnot for our fundraisers. And we've appreciated everything you've done, and we look forward to what happens next.
And you mentioned Make. I should also point out, because we mentioned it briefly at the beginning, that Make is shutting down as well. I hope Make Magazine can be saved. In addition, they have 125,000 subscribers, and again, how is that not a success? You can make that work, and we're here to help in any way possible, because the death of any printed magazine is a death for all of us, as somebody involved
Absolutely.
In printed magazines can say. But I think
Absolutely.
We really need to work together. Well, Sherry, thank you again
so much.
Thank
you guys for your support, too. It's meant a lot, and we'll keep going. Keep doing what we do.
All right, and we will see you again at some point, and hopefully we'll see all those people that would come to the Maker Faire at some other event in the future. And we'll keep you updated on this, and we'll keep you updated on the Strand as well. You can write to us, oth@2600.com. We are not on next week. We'll see you again in 2 weeks. Have a good night.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders of The Laura Flanders Show. The Left Forum is right around the corner, and they have generously donated weekend passes to WBAI listener supporters who make a $50 pledge in support of WBAI. I've had the pleasure of hosting many panels and plenaries at the Left Forum over the years, and I'm doing it again this time. I'll be hosting the Saturday plenary on the 50th anniversary of Stonewall and a session with Chris Hedges and Rick Wolff on Lennon. So come meet me, Laura Flanders, and the others at the 2019 Left Forum and be part of a conversation about radically imagining and building a different future. Make a pledge of $50 today and lock in your free weekend pass to the Left Forum, taking place in Brooklyn June 28th through June 30th. That's the 28th through the 30th in Brooklyn. Go to give, then the numeral 2, WBAI.org. That's give to WBAI.org and search Left Forum. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. See you at the Left Forum.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we explore the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the big stories in science, plus answer some of the emails that I get, because there's no way I can answer all these emails, so it's better just to do it on radio. Well, the big news that has been dominating the headlines for quite a while concerns flying saucers. That's right, once again, UFOs are dominating the headlines, this time because pilots, military pilots, are now speaking directly to the press, with the permission of the military, about their encounters with flying saucers. That's right. In fact, one pilot even said that he was in a near collision with a UFO. And they do all sorts of maneuvers that they've never seen before with a conventional aircraft. We're talking about zigzagging without exhaust. We're talking about withstanding G-forces of perhaps 400 times the force of gravity, which would be enough to crush any living organism, and the ability to rocket from zero, practically, up to 5 to 7 times the speed of sound. We're talking about hypersonic velocities that leave our jets in the dust. Now, what do we make of this? Well, on Exploration Today, we'll talk about some of the pros and cons, misconceptions, and, well, the unknowns concerning UFOs. First of all, it's a very hot topic. Years ago on Exploration, we even had a debate between a former Air Force official and somebody who wrote a best-selling book about the Roswell incident of 1947. And very quickly, the argument escalated, and with the point is that the people who believe in flying saucers said there's a cover-up, that the military is covering up information for whatever purpose. And the Air Force official says something rather interesting. He said, well, yeah, maybe there is a cover-up, but maybe it's done for the right reasons. And then the person who was advocating extraterrestrial civilizations at Roswell said that this is an example of dishonesty, because then how do we know what to believe? The military deliberately feeds news items to the press in order to, well, promote the UFO mythology, because it then takes media attention away from what the Air Force is really doing. In Area 51, it's believed that that's where the stealth bomber was perfected. Now, the stealth bomber is not an invisible bomber. It's a bomber that is designed so that it can deflect and diffuse radar signals that impinge upon it. So it's not invisible, but the shape, the distribution of metal, the distribution of conducting materials is chosen so that when radar hits the stealth bomber, the reflected radar signals are dispersed so that it has the radar signature of a large bird. Well, the stealth bomber was used successfully in the Iraq War, and it's an example of what the military can do if it's allowed to test in secrecy, said the Air Force official. So in other words, it's a matter of national security that the military had to deflect attention away from what it was doing. So it promoted the UFO mythology. And as a consequence, we were able to perfect stealth technology. Well, now we're talking about a whole new area of technology, hypersonic drive. The Russians just last year announced that they have perfected a hypersonic drone weapon that can pierce a Star Wars shield. Now, what does that do to the debate about UFOs? Well, let's try to take it systematically, because there's so many different ways this debate can go. There are three possibilities with regards to UFO sightings. One, it's a natural phenomenon that can be explained using ordinary physics. That's one large possibility. A new possibility is that they are military craft. For example, hypersonic drone vehicles that the Russians, the Chinese, and the Americans all test. They can zigzag. They can travel at hypersonic velocities 5 to 20 times the speed of sound. So maybe once again, just like the stealth bomber gave rise to lots of UFO sightings years ago, maybe these hypersonic drone weapons are creating the current wave of UFO sightings. But there's a third possibility. The third possibility is, well, let's put it right out, and that is they are in fact from outer space. They are extraterrestrial. So we'll say a few things about extraterrestrial civilizations and what we know or don't know about them. Okay, well, let's just jump right into those three possibilities. A, it's a natural phenomenon. B, they're military phenomenon used to cover up secret programs. And three, well, maybe they really do come from aliens from outer space. So let's take them one at a time. First of all, I get a lot of these sightings in my email, and I'd say about, well, roughly 95% of the time, they can be rather easily explained. So the first likely possibility that generates lots of UFO sightings are meteors. Meteors that come soaring right across the night sky. And sometimes these meteors even break up, giving the impression that the mothership is ejecting scout ships. Well, meteors do not zigzag. And that's what is causing a lot of consternation among military circles. What object can zigzag at such hypervelocities without crushing the electronics and the people inside? So meteors go in one direction, they burn up very quickly, and they can travel at hypersonic velocities, but they don't zigzag. So that's one thing that has to be taken into consideration. Another possibility as well, weather anomalies. It turns out that the weather anomalies can account for all sorts of different kinds of flying saucer sightings. Basically, you have cloud formations that are circular, rotate very rapidly, giving you the illusion that they are some kind of craft hovering in outer space. Then we have the possibility of, believe it or not, the planet Venus. It turns out that we are fooled by looking at objects that are very far away. How do we judge distance? We judge distance by moving our head. Objects that are close to us move a lot when we move our head, but the mountains far away hardly move at all when we move our head. Now, Venus is so far away and so bright that it gives us the illusion that it's following us. Children, for example, often say, "Mommy, Daddy, the moon is following me." And that's because the whole concept of parallax is distorted by looking at something that is so far away that it has no parallax at all. So it's like it's hovering right over your shoulder. In fact, once former President Jimmy Carter saw a flying saucer, he asked the military to look into it. And the military said that, well, to the best of its estimation, it was the planet Venus. So if you're driving down a country road all alone at night and you look over your shoulder and you see this bright object following you, what do? You make a left turn, a right turn, and then you look again and sure enough, it's still following you. And you have the distinct impression that the flying saucer is tailing you. Well, it's actually the planet Venus. Turns out that quite a few UFO sightings, especially those sightings where an object is basically following you, is nothing but the planet Venus. Another possibility is radar echoes. So people who are in radar installations sometimes see blips on their radar screen, but sometimes these blips are nothing but the reflection of radar off a mountain, and so we have basically a false signal. Another possibility is weather balloons. Now, this has to do with the Roswell incident of 1947. Eyewitness accounts say that something or other crashed in the desert in 1947. And who knows, maybe alien bodies were recovered. We don't have any more details than that. And it turns out that the military actually did do top secret experiments with weather balloon and something called Project Mogul. Now, whether or not the Roswell incident was generated by a weather balloon, we don't know. But we do know that the military was doing Cold War testing of the dispersion of radioactive materials in people's backyard. That's right. Believe it or not, according to newspapers in Albuquerque, it turns out the military was dispersing radioactive dust in people's backyards and via weather balloons and tracking the dispersion of radioactive materials to see how far they went. This was, of course, the Cold War. And because of the hysteria around the Cold War, the military was doing all sorts of shenanigans, trying to figure out how nuclear fallout was spread during and after a nuclear war. That's one reason why the military wanted to cover up the Roswell incident, because apparently that weather balloon, Project Mogul, was one of the weather balloons that was sent up to investigate the dispersion of radioactive materials in literally people's backyard. So it's something to think about when we realize that, yes, there were all sorts of shenanigans done by the military during the Cold War. In fact, there's something called MKUltra. MKUltra was a top-secret program initiated by the CIA over several decades, enlisting many professors of science at leading universities to do all sorts of bizarre experiments on mind reading,